This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to part two of season four, episode eight of Resolved Mysteries.
What a journey.
Wow. We all took that with you, Katie.
What? That's where we're at.
We're here.
We're here for it.
This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Carlin.
I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
Here we are in the same room again.
Yay!
Welcome to our show.
Forever.
As most of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And for this month, we are still doing the Epilepsy Foundation.
Suggested to us by our patron, Ruth.
If you'd like to recommend a nonprofit for us to support and support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes, two additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, and goodies in the mail.
Woohoo!
Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast. Okay. What are we talking about today?
All right. I'm famously talking about a mink coat thrown in the back seat by a woman named Going By. Ugh. Liza Montgomery. It's a Las Vegas Christmas fraudy, baby.
Yeah. And then I'm covering a missing segment, and it is the story of Deborah Poe and some other women who went missing around the same time.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Right. So this is a fraudy, and it's a lady fraudy, so we don't hate it, y'all.
We do like a lady fraudy.
And we get to see some 90s Las Vegas imagery. Oh, there's a lot to see in this segment. And it's Christmas time. It's a Christmas segment. So on the weekend shortly before Christmas of 1990, an eccentric young woman named Liza Montgomery began a bizarre and most unusual shopping spree. Oh, of course, this is a quote from Stack. Remarkable even in freewheeling Las Vegas. So we see her cute red car driving down this Las Vegas Strip. She's living her best life. And on Friday, December 21st, Liza Montgomery visited a local businessman named Mark Hughesby, who we hear a voiceover of in the segment, but we don't see him as a talking head. We do see a reenactor playing him. And she's responding to his newspaper ad where he was offering to sell an expensive white mink coat and a 2-carat diamond ring. And so she had called him, and he said, okay, you can have it, but please bring cash. And when she arrives at his home, she hands him a cashier's check, claiming that her bank had closed early, so she couldn't get enough cash out for the coat and ring. And he sort of says, I asked you to bring cash. And she's like, oh, it's just as good as cash. No problem. And he says, well, okay, can I see your ID? And she says, oh, okay, and hands it over to him. And he thought the ID was legitimate, and so the check must be legitimate. And he let her take the items home. And when I zoomed in on the cashier's check that they show, it either shows that it was for $11,500 or $17,500. Whoa. Either way, so much money.
Oh my gosh.
Lots of money. In 1990 money, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So he is also just miffed at how she throws that white mink coat in the back seat of the car with interior.
He was mortified.
The disregard. Yeah, he was very disappointed in her. So later that evening, after she's purchased already a 2-carat diamond ring and this very expensive mink coat, she goes to a jewelry store. And she's been in this jewelry store a few times. And this time, she's ready to purchase two rings that she had put on hold. So once again, she pays with a cashier's check. And this time, the cashier's check is for $39,000.
It's crazy.
Ugh, it's crazy. And the rings are gaudy as hell and full of diamonds.
Of course.
And the poor jewelry store owner, whose name is Smiles Zepeda.
I'm sorry. I didn't best notice
name
that.
Ever. Yeah, Smiles.
Smiles Zepeda, the best name ever. He says that he had seen Liza come in a few times, and she was always well-dressed and very polite and well-mannered, and he had no reason to suspect that she didn't have this amount of money. And when he hands her the rings, he tells her, "You're very fortunate to get both of these diamonds at this price." And she responds, "That's why they call me lucky." Which is such a Las Vegas thing to say. Oh, this reenactor is gorgeous. She's beautiful.
She's beautiful. Also, you're not lucky. You're a thief.
Yeah.
I guess you make your own luck, right?
She thinks it's luck. So at this time, Mark Hughesby is, I just picture him sitting at home like, "Oh no, I think I made a mistake."
You're right.
The one who sold her the coat and the ring.
Seriously.
So he drives over to the gated community where he had written down her address on her ID. And drives over there, he pulls up to the security guard, and he says, "Is there Liza Montgomery that lives here?" And the security guard's like, "Nope, nobody lives here by that name." Aww. Oof, which also would not happen today. Like, the security guard wouldn't give out that information.
Right.
But thankfully, he did, and Mark, poor Mark. Oh, poor buddy. I do feel so bad for him. Because it's like, he really tried. He was like, "Oh, I think I have a bad feeling, but I'm going to just accept it." Mm-hmm. And he made a mistake. So he turns his car around and drives straight to the police station. And we see Detective Paul Figlia of the Las Vegas Police Department. And oh my gosh, I don't know if you remember what he looks like, but he looks like he would be on any show on TV during that time as a cop. He's like 1990 handsome, mm-hmm, in a TV way.
Love it.
And he told Mark that they couldn't do anything until the bank received the check and determined that it was counterfeit. So they needed Mark to try to cash the cashier's check and have it not work for the police to be able to get involved.
Okay.
And they couldn't just go find her and detain her just because the address on the cashier's check and her ID was incorrect. He's like, "That could just be a mistake. Like, we don't have grounds to go get her."
Meanwhile, she's running around dropping more of these checks, honey, while they're waiting.
Yes, she is, honey.
So the next day, she goes to a furniture store, and she claims to be purchasing a Christmas gift for her husband, $23,000 worth of furniture, which is every man's dream. $23,000 worth of furniture that you didn't get to pick out. Merry Christmas. So again, she uses a cashier's check, and they accept it. And she had driven this hideous old brownish red, like, moving van to go get the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And she buys it all. Their workers are, like, packing it into this van. And it's not all fitting. And this is the first time that we see Liza start to be mean.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of starts to throw a fit. And the store owner says, "Well, it's okay. Like, you can just borrow one of our trucks and we'll drive the rest of it over to you." And she becomes belligerent and she demands that they fit everything in her van. She doesn't want to take their van. So they are able to, like, Tetris it all together in the back.
Very Tetris-y.
And then we've got, honey, some walkie-talkie action.
Yes, it's so good.
Because the furniture store owner, who's never named, he's also a little bit suspicious, probably after she started, like, throwing a fit. Because if you're really buying a gift for your husband, or, you know, you're legit, you'd be like, "Yeah, go ahead and
deliver it to my house
for free, happily."
Yes.
So he decides to follow the van that she's driving with all the furniture. And he's got his walkie-talkie. And on the other end of the walkie-talkie, honey, is his wife at home.
Yes.
Also, the longest range walkie-talkies you've ever seen.
Oh, that's very true.
Well, how is that working? Is it like
sat phones? Yeah. So he's kind of like updating her. And eventually he sees Liza park the van, give the keys to a man who gets in the van, And then she gets in her red convertible that had been parked in that area. And the van and with the man and then her and in her red convertible take off, and the furniture store owner keeps following them. Mm-hmm. And when the van carrying the furniture turned in a different direction than it would need to go for the address that she had given, the owner told his wife to call the police. Mm. Over that walkie-talkie, honey. Oh, so then the van turned from like the second lane, like the lane closest to the middle.
An illegal turn.
And it turns right.
Yes. Very dangerous.
Very dangerous and also very suspicious. So then Liza notices he's following her. This bitch in her white mink coat gets out of her car to go confront him. It's very scary, honestly. Yes. He's on his walkie-talkie saying, oh no, I gotta go. And like tries to speed away. And she's like, hey, what are you doing? And then he speeds past her. She runs in her giant mink coat in the middle of Las Vegas. Allison and I were talking about this. Like, it's gotta be 70 degrees there still.
But they said it's also that he thought that she had a gun, maybe.
Yes. Yes, Stack says the store owner was fearful that this angry woman in a white mink coat might be carrying a weapon.
It's like the best line ever.
She like opens the mink and it's just guns.
Just guns. So he sped away and she runs back to her car to follow him. And she follows him for 3 miles. And the store owner eventually pulls over to the side of the road. And then Liza Montgomery just speeds past him and disappears. Mm. So by this point, it's like very clear that she's up to no good. Yes. To all the men that she's
more grifting. Than a little sus. Yes.
Yeah. So in summary, in this weekend, she hit 12 places that the police are aware of, eventually became aware of. And the amount of loss to all of those places was around $150,000.
Wow.
Her last place that she hit was a gaming supply store where she bought 3 slot machines.
What is she going to do with all this stuff?
What are you doing? Exactly. What are you doing? You're buying the largest things that you have to have, like, big vans to get where you need to go.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Stick with the jewels that are untraceable.
It's not a stealthy operation.
3 slot machines and a truck full of furniture. Where is she going?
Crazy.
Oh, my God.
So police search the area because at this point they're realizing, okay, I mean, it's a good thing Mark Hughesby came forward. He was suspicious and he came forward when he did versus like waiting for the cashier's check. They at least had this woman's name in the Las Vegas Police Department did, even though they couldn't do anything with the first part. But then when the furniture store owner was wife calls, she gave the same name, which is probably also another mistake. Like, use different names throughout, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of just Liza Montgomery the whole time.
Yeah.
So they look all over for her and can't find her. A few weeks after this weekend, they find her car and the van, that hideous van, and both of them had been rented. So investigators learned that she'd rented them using a cash deposit instead of a credit card. This is the one time she'll pay cash. And the rental agency gave police one clue, a copy of her ID. On the ID, it is her actual picture, but with the name Liza Montgomery. But at least they had a picture of what she looked like now. Mm. So there isn't like a ton more to this case. This woman just had a great weekend, I guess. But the case was she was found because of a UM airing, and actually an Oregon police officer who saw the broadcast was investigating a similar case already and like knew about her somehow. I can't find any information about how, but her real identity is Ellen Christine Huvera Saiz, and they were able to locate her in Hollywood, California, of course. So she pled guilty to burglary and theft and served time in a Nevada state penitentiary. And after her release, she was free for a while. And then from what I can find, she was later arrested and sentenced to prison in Colorado. Mm. So then it's just kind of like, oh, this woman's having a hard life and I don't want to dig into too much. So Truth Finder says, like, some of the things on her record are careless driving, no valid driver's license, and then really serious things like child abuse.
Oh my God.
Or reckless cause, which could be like from the careless driving with a kid in the car, maybe.
Oh.
License plates violations, giving false information, and then one of the things says any act of prostitution, which I'm never like, please stop. Please stop ticketing people for prostitution. But
or arresting them, yeah.
Yeah, or arresting them. So that's all I could find. It looks like she's still alive. It looks like she was released in October of 2016, living in Colorado, registered as a Democrat to vote. So we love that. But this is like me digging very far. But I hope she's doing okay because, I don't know, it's kind of sad that long of a life of running in with the law.
Yeah.
And, yeah. But yeah, I would just love to sit down and talk to her and be like, tell me about this weekend and what your plan was.
Yeah,
this exactly. Stuff. Gonna do?
Like, were you going to sell it? Were you going to?
She must have been, right?
I don't know. And then I couldn't find, like, was the furniture ever recovered? You know, the stuff that the she stuff. Actually took.
Like, where did she put it? Where did it
Where's
go?
Where's that white mink coat?
We need it? To know mostly about the coat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is wild.
So, mostly not a big update, but kind of a fun segment to watch.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It was super fun. I loved it.
Yeah. It was very funny. Wild. That's it.
Okay, right. Good job.
We all love a great true crime mystery. And now you can put your detective skills to the test with the free Small Town Murders Crime Mystery Puzzle Game. From the makers of Angry Birds, there's a new crime mystery puzzle game everyone is talking about. Small Town Murders. It has 5 million players already. You can solve puzzles to unlock clues and evidence, meet colorful townspeople and swap gossip for juicy leads, interrogate suspects, solve the case, and find the killer. There are more than 3,000 levels and over 2,000 clues and pieces of evidence to collect. There are also 20 cases and new cases added every month. You can interact with interesting characters and visit hundreds of beautiful locations. Use your detective skills to find the best strategy with brain-teasing Match 3 puzzles. I love Small Town Murders. There are so many cases, and it's gorgeous to look at. There's a whole world that you can immerse yourself in. I've been playing for weeks now, and I cannot put it down. So join me and over 5 million other players and become a detective today. All you have to do is download Small Town Murders free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. You're going to love this interactive murder mystery game. That's Small Town Murders on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
If you like true crime, dark history, the haunted and paranormal, then we think you'll like Ghost Town.
Ghost Town is hosted by me, Rebecca Lieb.
And me, Jason Horton.
We cover both notorious and obscure true crimes.
The haunted, paranormal, and unexplained.
And the dark history of everything from world events to pop culture.
There are new episodes of Ghost Town every Wednesday and Friday.
Find out for yourself what Vulture.com called essential listening and one listener called a total waste of time.
So pause the podcast you're listening to right now.
And go subscribe to Ghost Town for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And at ghosttownpod.com.
Did you hear about the Welsh tourists who got drunk and stole a penguin named Dirk from SeaWorld on the Gold Coast? Or the Canadian guy who tried to beat a breathalyzer test by eating his own underpants? Hey, I'm Tara Saraband from World's Dumbest Criminals, an upbeat podcast about deadbeat crims. Join me every Monday to hear about the most ridiculous, bizarre, and downright stupid crimes and criminals in the world ever. Like the Australian man who put out an unsuccessful hit on his wife and freaked out when she crashed her own funeral. Or the Chinese woman who deliberately ran 49 red lights in her ex-boyfriend's car. World's Dumbest Criminals is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Make sure you subscribe if you don't want to miss any criminally stupid shenanigans.
All right. So this is the last segment of season four, episode eight, seven. Where are we?
Eight.
I have no idea. Eight.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a missing person segment, but it's pretty wild. It's not just, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be, which is what Eliza said we should call this podcast moving forward. Okay, so
if we ever rebrand, that is it.
So February 4th, 1990, at 4:30 a.m., sheriff's deputies responded to a call at a convenience store in Orlando, Florida. Two customers found the all-night market open but unattended. In the reenactment, a man is telling officers that he stopped by the store to say hello to a friend, but he doesn't know where she is. He says, quote, "She just kind of disappeared." Deputies searched for the missing clerk, and behind the counter, they found a work smock neatly folded. The cash register was locked, and there was no evidence of a robbery. Detective Riggs Gay at the Orange County, Florida Sheriff's Department says that there was no signs of a struggle, and nothing appeared to be missing from the store, with the exception of the store clerk. Stack says that the missing clerk was 26-year-old Deborah Deanne Poe, who had worked days at a local newspaper and nights at the store. Deborah had moved to Orlando just 4 months earlier with her roommate and friend, Lori Tillman. Lori Tillman says that she and Deborah were like sisters. She says that they had a very unusual friendship. She says that they could fight like sisters and ignore each other like sisters, but they were there for each other, and they could always count on one another if they needed anything. Stack says that the most dangerous time for convenience store employees is the graveyard shift. Mm. Deborah's shift was five nights a week from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and she was behind the counter alone. Lori says that Deborah worked hard because she had just bought a new car and she wanted to buy a house and start a business. Mm-hmm. Lori says, quote, "And if that meant working two full-time jobs that she didn't really like, well, then that's what she would do."
Gosh.
Stack says that around 11 p.m. the night Deborah disappeared, a friend of hers stopped by the store to see her and discuss some house plans with her. Police verified that Deborah waited on customers from her friend's visit until 3:05 a.m., when her friend returned at 3:50 a.m., Deborah was nowhere to be found. So that's a really tight window of time.
Yeah.
Detective Gay says that Deborah's car was parked in the same spot as when she came to work, and it was locked and her purse was sitting in the back seat. Investigators concluded that Poe had probably been abducted. Stack says that they soon discovered that Deborah Poe was not the first clerk to disappear in Florida during the graveyard shift.
And I'm just like, yeah. It's unacceptable to have these women working overnight alone.
Yes. What are we thinking?
After and one goes missing, let's not do that.
And when I was doing research, I mean, I'll come back to it, but this happened six or seven times in Florida, just Florida.
Ugh.
It happened so frequently. And why were these women left alone? I mean,
But then it's so sad because it's just like the women being able to run alone conversation. Like,
yes.
We should be able to work when we have to work.
Yes.
Well, and that's the thing. That was the only time she could do this.
Yes. Because she worked all day.
Working her ass off.
I know. It's enraging. So 6 months earlier, on August 6th, 1989, 29-year-old Donna Callahan disappeared from a convenience store in Gulf Breeze, Florida. As in Deborah's case, there was no signs of a struggle at the scene. Donna was 3 months pregnant and left behind a 2-year-old daughter. 5 weeks later, on September 18th, 1989, 36-year-old Darlene Messer was abducted from a Lake City, Florida convenience store. 2 days later, Darlene's body was found in a nearby creek, and she had been bludgeoned to death. Stack says the three victims are all single females in their 20s and 30s and all vanished working a graveyard shift alone. Mm. Investigators believe that the cases were linked but had no suspect. Then 3 days after Deborah Poe's disappearance, authorities were contacted by a young woman. Authorities believe that she may have come face-to-face with the abductor. So the witness is interviewed in shadow, and she says that she stopped by the store at around 3:30 in the morning to pick up a pack of cigarettes, and there was only one person in the store, and he appeared to be the clerk. She says, looking back at it now, the clerk didn't seem to know where the cigarettes were, but she thought that maybe the employee was new. She says that the man had long stringy hair and a cross earring and a skull ring and that he had a Megadeth t-shirt on.
But the reenactor was like into it. She was like flirting.
Yeah. And like she was really flirty. It was super cute.
Yeah. Funny because it was like stringy hair. And I was like, oh, they're not saying nice things about this guy, but she loved it in the reenactment.
He was cute. He was good looking. I was like, I don't think that this is historically accurate.
A death metal, stringy-haired hottie.
Yeah, he was a cutie. Here's another tidbit that UM left out that sort of calls validity of this story into question. Mm-hmm. Because not only was this man apparently wearing a Megadeth t-shirt, but this woman said that he drove a Megadeth van, that there was a van in the parking lot that had a Megadeth design on it.
Oh.
Wow.
So how many people are living in this area
with
with a Megadeth van? Like, yeah. How could you not then find this guy?
Seriously.
So there is a lot of speculation on the internet as to whether this story is true, whether it's partially true and she embellished the van or – yeah. So it is – it's interesting because we had another case that I covered. I think I covered it on Patreon. And the person who abducted this little girl – I can't remember her name right now.
Oh, yes. But with the mural on the van.
Yes, it was a van with a mural. And it's like, how can you not, unless immediately, as soon as this person left, they hid the van or they painted over it immediately, right. How can you not find something like that?
Right.
Detective Gay says that they haven't been able to locate anyone else who can confirm if this man was in the store or when they were in the store.
It was at 3:30 a.m.
Yeah, totally, right? So Gay theorizes that the man could have come in, discovered no one was in the store, and taken the opportunity to shoplift or steal something, or that he might be responsible in part for the abduction of Deborah Poe. He says there's a good possibility that they are dealing with an individual who is a serial type of person who abducts these people. Mm. Staff then gives a description of Poe, and her friend Tillman says that if they don't find her alive, then they can at least put her to rest and go after her killer. Then there's an update that says William Alex Wells confessed to killing Donna Callahan and led police to her body in a remote area of Florida. Wells then implicated his half-brother, Mark Reby, in the murder, and both are serving life sentences. The update then says that Deborah Poe is still missing and the murder of Darlene Messer remains unsolved.
And I'm sorry, were the cases of the other girls super close by?
They were not super close by.
Oh.
No.
Okay.
They were, I read somewhere that one was 100 miles from where Deborah went missing and that another one was 300 miles.
Okay. So, I mean, this happens.
It happened so frequently at this
time. So to think these are connected is pretty out there. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So the segment was actually not that long. And it was about Deborah Poe, but then they threw in Donna Callahan and Darlene Messer, and then they gave us an update about Donna Callahan. So I looked into all three, so I'm going to go by each. So we're going to talk about Deborah Poe first. So Deborah Poe grew up in Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C., and she moved to Orlando in October of 1989. She was renting a duplex with a female roommate, Lori, who was interviewed, and she wanted to buy a home and start her own catering business. At the time of her disappearance, she worked two jobs. The first was a daytime position in the retail sales department of the Orlando Sentinel newspaper, who did extensive coverage on this case. And then the second was as a clerk at the Circle K at the corner of Hall Road and Aloma Avenue. So I found a woman who was friends with Deborah in college, and she described her as, quote, "Debbie was my best friend in college from 1981 to 1982. We both promised to go back to the same school the following year, but we did not. We did our best to keep in contact while she was alive, but communication got further and further apart over the years. Deb was unique and very quirky. She liked having control of situations. She chose her friends for sure. She was the girl who hung back in college and watched everyone for a while. Once she decided who she wanted to be friends with, then she would approach them. She picked me, as I am somewhat quirky myself, and we had a lot of classes together. Deb was a big flirt, but she was also outspoken, and if she didn't like a guy, she would be somewhat cruel in letting him know that she wasn't interested. Sometimes she would try to lead a guy on, and then when he showed interest, she would drop him. She and I were both nut magnets. If there was a crazy person anywhere in the vicinity of either of us, they would find us. She said, that sort of crazy has followed me around in my life as well. Neither of us understood why they liked us. She and I handled them differently, though. I would be nice and try to get them to leave me alone with kindness. Deb, on the other hand, would find something to say to the creep that was mean or hurtful. She felt it would work quicker and easier. I was always afraid that they would get mad and retaliate. Deb was also quite smart about things. So when I learned this happened to her, I was shocked. The year that we spent together in college, there were two girls that had been murdered and disemboweled. Deb, Tanya, her roommate, and I hung out in their room and ate popcorn while listening to Foreigner Journey and talked about this. Mm. We had all agreed about using the buddy system, and Deb talked a lot about personal safety and knew a ton of things about self-protection. I used one of the things the following year that she taught me, and I'm certain it saved my life. I've always been grateful to Deb for that bit of information. So Debra's boyfriend at the time, obviously, was a man named Scott Iagi. He is the guy in the reenactment who says that he came to see his friend. So that was actually her boyfriend. And I don't know why he said it was his friend, right. But he worked at another Circle K. And I read an article in the Orlando Sentinel, and Iagi was interviewed. And he said, I started working the night shifts with her for the last month. And then one night I listened to her when she said, honey, there's no need for both of us to not get sleep. I don't need you to be my protector all the time. He said, I could kick myself.
Oh, my God.
So Iagi left shortly after 11 p.m. on Saturday and returned to check on her minutes after she was reported missing. Quote, just walking out is not Debra. She's too level-headed, conscientious, and professional in her job. Even when she's tired, she has it all together, he said. So Scott Iagi was a suspect. And it seems as though the police believe that he may have been involved. So he would check on her at work all of the time. And at first I was like, what is this friend doing? He's coming in, hanging out with her, and then coming back at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I think that's kind of what he did because he was worried about her. So it's interesting because I found some information that said that Scott Iagi was very cooperative with law enforcement. He passed a lie detector test and was genuinely concerned about her safety by frequently visiting her at the store in the middle of the night. But on the other hand, he would have known how vulnerable she was, and it would have been easy to fabricate a cover story of her being abducted while working alone. Mm-hmm. It seems like in the articles I read, initially he may have been a suspect and then later was not a suspect. It also seems law enforcement knows who the Megadeth person is but has never named them.
Oh.
They believe that the Megadeth person could have been the boyfriend of another person that worked at the Circle K. So I don't know if they investigated him and then released him, or I'm not sure. But so by 2002, Scott Iagi had become a minister. So there was a search of property across the street from the church where Iagi was a minister in 2015. So I think that they are like really looking at him for some reason.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So a carton of chocolate milk and a cup of coffee had been left on a stack of house plans behind the counter, and the Circle K mock was neatly folded nearby. The register was locked, and it appeared that no merchandise had been taken or moved out of place, and it seemed like that she had disappeared into thin air. And I think people were wondering, like, why is her smock folded? And then smokers were like, she probably had to take her smock off to go smoke outside, yeah. So she probably folded it up. So that means that either she was lured outside by someone or she went outside and then was abducted outside.
Yeah.
So a search dog hit on two spots on the pavement behind the Circle K. The first was behind a deserted business next door, and the second followed her scent out the back of the store through a space in a tall wooded fence into the parking lot of the Scholl's apartment complex next door, and then promptly lost the scent. So that led detectives to believe that Debra had either voluntarily entered or been dragged into a waiting vehicle. It was quickly apparent that the nature of Debra's work made her an easy target for abduction. As a young, attractive woman working at a gas station alone at night, in an era before there were security cameras in every building, she was frequently harassed by customers who ranged from harmlessly creepy to downright dangerous in the few short months. Remember, she had only been there 4 months.
Gross.
The most frightening incident happened just 2 weeks before her disappearance when a naked man burst into the Circle K and climbed over the counter toward Debra.
Oh.
He chased her around the interior of the store a couple times, then outside and around the gas pumps until she was able to beat him back into the store and lock the doors.
Oh my God.
Imagine. Imagine.
God. That's no.
When we were 16, my friend worked at Subway and she would close the fucking place by herself, 16.
Yep.
And one night a man came and exposed himself, like trench coat exposed himself in the window at her while she was closing.
That is awful.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. These guys just, you're trapped there, so they're going to do whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want. Detectives interviewed a bunch of people after she went missing because of the nature of her job.
Mm.
One was a man who had been harassing Poe because she told him she wouldn't date him. Another was a woman who came to the store drunk at about 8 p.m. that evening after she found Poe's name and work number in her husband's wallet.
What?
It's a carnival. Yes. A cavalcade of suspects.
Truly a freak show.
Yes. The last person to see her was the manager of a Kentucky Fried Chicken. He would stop regularly at the store to buy scratch-off lottery tickets and sandwiches. And he said that Poe is fine at 3 a.m.
Gosh, I'm even surprised they had this many people to talk to. I guess a lot of people shop these places in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Everything else is closed, yeah. You know? So. Yeah. So once she got the full-time job at the Orlando Sentinel, her boyfriend and family begged her to quit the Circle K, saying it was too dangerous and that she was working too much.
Yeah.
When that failed, her boyfriend worked alongside of her, but she told him he didn't have to anymore, and she disappeared like a couple of weeks later.
Gosh, that poor boyfriend, if he didn't have anything to do
and
with
then
it.
To be the suspect, too.
Yeah. That's awful.
Yeah, if he didn't do it, I'm sure his life has been ruined by this. With the Megadeth man, although authorities first considered him responsible for Deborah's abduction, it seems they've shifted over the years toward believing that he was actually a witness and possibly the boyfriend of another employee at the store. And you have to really think about this tight timeline. We saw this in the murder of Tracy Kirkpatrick. 45 minutes went by, and that was it. She was gone.
Yeah.
In Tracy's instance, murdered. They said the Megadeth man had no visible scratches on him. He was calm. He was flirting with the girl. He did actually say, you really shouldn't smoke, you know, when he was giving her the cigarettes.
Right, like
the,
yeah.
In the reenactment.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you kidnap this girl, put her in your car, and then go back into the store to get caught? It just doesn't make any sense. So I don't think that he had anything
doesn't
to do
add
with
up.
It. Someone commented that it's possible that the cigarette-buying woman got her dates wrong and actually went to the store when Megadeth's girlfriend was working. Deborah's boyfriend mentioned something about helping her out in the store in the wee hours of the morning, so it's possible that Megadeth did the same thing for his girlfriend. This person said, you know, maybe his girlfriend went to the bathroom or outside to smoke, and he would man the register until she came back.
Mm-hmm.
Although everyone wonders, like, why didn't anyone come forward and say, like, hey, you got the dates wrong, or it was me, because it's not a crazy populated area, especially back then. Yeah, and originally police didn't go public with any information about him because they were afraid that they were going to scare him out of Orange County and he would flee. But after 3 months with no success in identifying him, they created that composite sketch.
Mm-hmm.
In August of 1990, a man riding an ATV found the skeletal remains of a young woman off of Alamo Avenue, 2 miles from where Deborah was last seen. They initially believed that the remains were Deborah's due to the location and physical similarities, but the family didn't recognize the woman's jewelry. They eventually were ruled out via dental records.
Mm.
The segment that aired originally on November 6, 1991, generated over 150 leads from viewers around the country. Most of them were for people saying that they had seen or knew the Megadeth man. Orange County detectives received a call from authorities in Virginia who said that they had a similar case and a suspect in custody who matched the description. So this isn't just Florida. People are abducting and murdering overnight clerk workers all of the time.
Yes.
God.
It's just a common thing, unfortunately.
Yeah. And actually, I probably say this later, one of these disappearances finally triggered, I think they created a law in Florida now that there has to be two people working overnight shifts, not just one person.
Good.
It did eventually create some change.
Wow. And like an actual law.
Yeah.
Wow.
Detectives looked into multiple suspects over the next few years, although they were never able to charge anyone. One was an ex-boyfriend Deborah broke up with because she believed he was mentally unstable. And in 1998, detectives had said that they zeroed in on a man who used to talk about Deborah's disappearance constantly, but now refuses to discuss it with anyone. But that was 98. Nothing came of that. On March 27, 2002, a team of over a dozen sheriff's detectives and search and rescue volunteers scoured an empty lot behind the Chapel Hill Baptist Church. Law enforcement had long considered the one-acre lot, which is 3 to 4 miles from the Circle K, a possible location of Deborah's remains, as it was near the home of a suspect in the case. Law enforcement stated they had a suspect but did not name the person. Not long after they dug up the lot behind the Chapel Hill Baptist Church, because 5 or 6 cadaver dogs had indicated the scent of human remains, they dug for 12 hours with a backhoe and they found nothing. And the Chapel Hill Baptist Church was right across the street from Scott Iagi's former residence, and he was a one-time pastor of that church. So they were definitely looking at him in 2002. This article says detectives didn't discount the possibility that Deborah's remains had been buried there at some point and then moved at a later date, which is just, ugh.
Yeah.
The Orlando Sentinel, the newspaper that Deborah briefly worked for, ran a missing persons ad in the classified section every day for 11 years after her abduction, ending in December of 2001. So I found some people who commented on sitcoms online. So the user 1990UM fan said, this was back in the early aughts. Deborah's mother at the time was the only living relative, still searching for Deborah. Deborah's father and older brother both died. Mm. Her brother fell and froze to death outside of his home.
No. Oh my God.
Just like a tragic accident. Oh. And then her father died of cancer.
Oh.
A family beset by tragedy. Oh. In a newspaper interview, Deborah's mother said at the time that her boyfriend, Scott Iagi, and her roommate, Lori Tillman, had completely broken off contact with her, which is so sad. In 2013, a sitcoms online user, the Dr. Strangelove, wrote, it's well believed that William Alex Wells and Mark Reby were responsible for Deborah's disappearance. They were convicted for a similar abduction and murder in Florida. They are both serving time in North Florida. Wells is serving life without parole and Reby 25 to life. They only confessed to one murder because that victim was found. However, Deborah and another convenience store clerk are still missing. There were numerous cases similar to this throughout Florida, South Georgia, and Alabama. Because of the Poe case, convenience stores in Florida have to have either two people on duty or a protective barrier like banks have.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
This person says, I actually installed video cameras and a DVR in that former Circle K, which is now a Sitco, when it was sold in 2011. Even today, when it's dark outside, it's quite isolated. More than 20 years ago, it would have been very isolated, surrounded by woods and scrub brush.
Oh, gosh.
So if you have any information, contact the Orange County Sheriff's Office at 407-836-4357. So that's Deborah Poe. The next victim, Donna Callahan. Donna Callahan was 29 and pregnant when she disappeared from a junior food store in a Pensacola suburb on August 6, 1989, leaving behind her purse, her keys, and her car. Her remains were found in 1996 in a rural area about 75 miles northeast of Defuniak Springs and identified using dental records. William Alex Wells of Defuniak Springs was already serving a 30-year prison term for robbing another convenience store, and he was charged with murdering Callahan. Just as his trial began, Wells offered to plead no contest and tell police officers what he knew about the crime in exchange for life in prison. So this story is freaking crazy. Our amazing, amazing hero and queen, Heather Crystal Dawn, of lostandfoundblogs.com, had a write-up about it. And I'm just going to tell you what she said because she's incredible.
Yes. And we trust.
This story is insane. So I'm not going to get into it. But in this article, she is interviewing the daughter of a murderer and kind of like what that's about what that's like. Yeah. So this is what Heather has to say. Mark Reby was never on the radar of police until his half-brother, Alex Wells, while serving a lengthy prison term in the 1990s, confessed in a prison Bible study group that he had participated in killing a woman.
Mm.
Some inmates overheard the confession and alerted the authorities.
But the Bible study group wasn't going to?
No. I mean, I don't know. According to Alex, the brothers went to a convenience store in Gulf Breeze, Florida, on August 16, 1989, with the intent to rob it. The clerk's purse was still on the counter, and it is believed that no money was even taken. But unfortunately, the cashier, Donna Callahan, was. In the early months of her second pregnancy, she begged for her life and the life of her unborn child, but her pleas were ignored, and she was ultimately strangled in the backseat of the brother's car.
No.
Each brother still insists that the other did the actual killing, but what is known is that her body was placed in the trunk and not too long after buried in a wooded area directly next to the brother's family property in Defuniak Springs, Florida.
So each brother blamed the other one.
Yeah.
Oh.
What a set.
Great.
Truly. Alex led them to the remains years later, and they both pled no contest to first-degree murder to avoid the death penalty. In the months after Mark Reby began his 25-year-to-life prison sentence, he apparently began to confess to other murders to his mother and sister. He told them that they needed to get a hold of Special Agent Dennis Halley, a retired FDLE agent, and get him down here because, quote, it will be mind-boggling what I'm about to tell him. His family did as he requested, so Special Agent Halley made the 7-hour drive to the Union Correctional Institution to talk to him. What he was about to say was incredible, to say the least. He told Dennis Halley, quote, "I killed a lot of girls. I'm a serial killer." Mark Reby then proceeded to confess to a shocking 12 more murders.
No. Oh, my gosh.
So a few months later, and after being taken out numerous times to show police where the crimes took place, Mark Reby recanted all of the confessions.
Oh, my God.
Stop.
So some of the murders that Reby confessed to, Special Agent Halley doesn't really believe. He would mention murdering a female in a specific town, but the details he gave were extremely vague or didn't match up with any disappearances or murders he could find. A few were even similar to the murders that Otis Toole and Henry Lee Lucas confessed to. And it was discovered later that Mark Reby and Otis Toole did do time at the same jail in the past.
Whoa.
Special Agent Halley does, however, believe that Mark Reby committed at least 7 murders in addition to Callahan's. And he does believe that his half-brother Alex Wells was complicit in 2 of them. In 4 of these confessions, Halley believes they are legitimate because of the very detailed things that Reby told him that only the killer would know. So Bonnie Gail Reither is thought to be Mark Reby's first victim. She was a 27-year-old cocktail waitress, and he was only 17 when her murder occurred on April 5th, 1978.
Ugh.
In his confession, he said they met in Wayside Park, and they were smoking dope, and he got angry and he killed her in her car.
Ugh.
He said he partially buried her body and left it and her car in a park, but couldn't remember exactly which one. He also made a point during the confession to mention he liked to drink Busch Tallboy beers. Incidentally, Bonnie's Ford Pinto had been found abandoned in Ferry Park, Fort Walton Beach. Her battered body would be found 6 days later, partially buried with a few cans of Busch Tallboy beers scattered around her
room.
Jackie Brandt was an 18-year-old who had traveled to Panama City Beach for spring break and wasn't officially reported missing. Her parents did call police to check on her in around April of 1986 when she was thought to have disappeared. When her remains were found on November 30th, 1986, they had been skeletonized, and there was no way to tell the cause of death, and due to that, it wasn't even classified as a homicide.
Mm.
Then years later, Mark Reby confessed that he had murdered her. He said that he had met her at a bar called The Playground that she frequented. They left together, and he got angry and strangled her in her car. He was able to accurately describe her clothing and took police to where he remembered burying her, which did end up being about 10 feet from where her remains had been found years earlier.
Mm.
35-year-old Linda Sams was a doctor's wife, and she and her family were vacationing at the Seaward condo complex in Miramar Beach. Mark Reby said that he was at a convenience store across the street and happened to see her Jaguar parked out front. He even remembered the vanity plates. He said that he was going to be, quote, a cat burglar and do a robbery. He had entered the condo and was crawling around on the bedroom floor. But when Lindsay Sands got up in the night to get a drink of water, she encountered Reby. Mm. He proceeded to beat her in the head with a pry bar during the vicious assault. And he fled the scene. And hours later, her daughter was horrified to find her mother bloody and unconscious.
Oh, my God.
She was lifelined in very critical condition, and she lingered, dying 11 months later due to her injuries.
Stop it.
Reby was able to accurately describe to the police the jewelry he took, the precise layout of the 3-story condo, and even the railing that was pulled off the wall during the assault.
Okay. God.
Yep.
Rhonda Taylor. Mark said that he and Rhonda were looking for crack cocaine to purchase. He said that the person who sold it to him, an African-American male, ended up coming with them to hang out and smoke crack. They had exited her car after doing the drugs, and Rhonda got extremely hot and removed her clothing. Her and Mark Reedy proceeded to get into a heated argument when he stabbed her repeatedly. The African-American male tried to step in, and Reby stabbed his hand as well. Afterwards, Mark put Rhonda's body in the back seat of his silver Buick and parked it where his wife at the time was working that night. Rhonda was found undressed and her clothing found in the car with no blood on it and no cuts from the stab wounds, which backed up Reby's story. Also noteworthy, years later, the only DNA found in the car belonged to a bloody towel, and it was eventually tested and did belong to an African-American male that police were not even aware was at the scene. So Special Agent Dennis Halley believes that Mark Reby may be involved with 2 other disappearances that he did not confess to. During his confession interview with police, he made a point to say he was not responsible for the disappearance of Andrea Durham. Police never even mentioned the case to Reby at all, so him bringing it up and his claim that he wasn't involved was very curious. She was 13 years old at the time of her disappearance. Her mother and sister had left her home to vacuum their residence at the Royal Apartments in Fort Walton Beach while they attended a meeting. And when they returned 2 hours later, the vacuum was still out, but Andrea was gone. Her purse and belongings were all still in the apartment, and there was no signs of a struggle. There was a connection to Mark Reby, as his stepdaughter and stepson were friends with Andrea, and she had been to their house many times before, and she remains missing to this day. And then the second one that he believes he could be involved in is the disappearance of Deborah Poe. Special Agent Hallie told Heather that Mark and his brother, Alex, were together the weekend that Deborah Poe was abducted and that they had a close relative that lived in the area. There were reports by several people of an unknown man in the convenience store after Deborah Poe went missing who was standing behind the counter. One of the witnesses who interacted with the unknown man picked Alex Wells out of a lineup as the man she had seen in the store that night. Deborah Poe, to this day, has never been found.
Oh.
So, Mark Reby is looking pretty good for it. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. He wasn't even on law enforcement's radar. His brother was always in trouble, but he wasn't. Ugh. His brother just starts talking in this Bible group, and all of a sudden he is a serial killer. He's like murdered all of these women.
Well, no, he just, every time, he just got angry. So
he got angry.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They made him do it, obviously. And then the last woman they mention is a woman named Darlene Messer. 36-year-old Darlene Messer had moved from Calgary, Canada to Florida in 1987 to marry and be close to her pen pal, Charles Messer, who was in prison serving a 12-year sentence for his involvement in the robbery and murder of a convenience store clerk in West Florida. What the hell is going on?
Oh, my God.
So this woman left Canada, she left her daughter, a 16-year-old daughter, behind, moved to Florida, married this man, Charles Messer. He was supposed to get parole.
They were pen pals while he was in jail?
Mm-hmm. Ugh. They met while he was in jail. So they got married in 1988, and he was supposed to get parole in 1989, and she had gotten a job at the Swanee Swiftly convenience store. So on September 18th, 1989, Darlene was abducted from the store during her 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. Investigators discovered that the store had been robbed of some items and that she had struggled with her assailants. The store was a wreck, and money was scattered all over the store and the parking lot. 2 days later, her body was found face down in 6 inches of water under the Swift Creek Bridge in Union County by a railroad conductor who flagged a Florida Highway Patrol officer down. Initial reports said that she had been shot in the back of the head, but later investigators would say there was, quote, like a ball peen hammer kind of look to her skull.
Oh.
That was kind of crushed, and she had some claw marks that were indicative of a hammer. Her father's quoted in the newspaper as saying, she was probably killed the night she was taken from the store because her body had been in the creek for quite some time. And at the time, Darlene's mother, Helen, was visiting her daughter. So she's visiting her, and she just disappears while she's there.
Oh, sad. Oh, my God. Nightmare.
Yeah. And I was I couldn't really find very much about Darlene. And then I found a 2021 article from just a couple months ago.
Oh, wow.
From a newspaper called First Coast News that had an interview with Darlene Messer's daughter, Angela, who was 16 at the time of her mother's disappearance and murder, and she was living in Calgary, Canada. And then Lieutenant Todd Lusser, who was with the Columbia County Sheriff's Office. So Lusser said the last people to see Messer alive was a Georgia couple that stopped to get coffee and a snack at the store at around 12:38 a.m. He says a couple hung out on the tailgate of their truck for about 15 minutes and then went to leave. As they were leaving, they remembered this vehicle specifically and vividly because they almost struck it. They described it as a Pontiac Grand Prix, in their words, a, quote, Heinz 57 color vehicle. Within minutes, the silent alarm would go off in the store, alerting local authorities. But when they arrived, they found a store in disarray. Money and items from the counter were strewn on the ground, and Messer was gone. Ominously, a man's belt was left at the scene, looped through at the end, as if it was used to hold somebody down.
No.
Messer's purse that contained her handgun still sat on a crate by the counter untouched. Investigators in 1989 began looking into a suspect who committed a robbery around the same time. They had a tip that someone had seen a blue car in the area with a woman screaming inside. Their suspect had a blue car and violent history. Lesser says that that's where the investigators spent a lot of time. But as technology progressed, technicians at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement were able to take blood found on the bridge and isolate two DNA samples, Messer's DNA and the DNA of someone else. The belt at the Swanee Swiftly store also had DNA, but neither sample matched the suspect in the blue car. But there are others. Lessier says, I'm just going to call them Roger and Robert. They were arrested 10 days prior to the robbery at the Suwanee Swifty in a Heinz Color Pontiac Grand Prix, a strikingly similar description to the car that the Georgia couple described. In the arrest report for the incident 10 days prior to the robbery, Lessier says that the sergeant wrote he believed the two were going to rob the Suwanee Swiftly. The report also notes that when the deputy went to speak to them, one of the men was under a Pontiac Grand Prix fixing what appeared to be an oil leak. The vehicle that abducted her and took off had some sort of type of major oil leak. So yeah, it throws up a lot of red flags, says Lessier. However, a crucial piece of evidence doesn't match. Lessier took DNA samples from Roger and Robert, and neither matched the DNA found on the belt or in the blood. Quote, is it possible there's a third person with them and he was the one? That is why we need the public's help. Who were these other two running with? Asked Lessier. There's also speculation that Messer's murder was connected to another murder of another clerk named Eileen Mangold. They vanished from Florida stores within days of each other, but it hasn't been proven. In 1999, Franklin Smith was arrested and charged in Eileen Mangold's murder after the DNA and palm print evidence linked him to the crime scene. However, he was acquitted of the crime a year later, and it isn't known if he is still considered a suspect in Darlene's murder. And then I just have a little bit about Angela. Messer's daughter, Angela Tenney, visits the bridge, the scene where she was discovered, I think annually. And she was interviewed and she says, you just look around and wonder, well, how would I have gotten away? Which way did she run? And then you remember that it doesn't matter. Mm. So Lessier wants to speak with people that may have known or worked with the two brothers that he can't name and another accomplice at that time. And for Angela Tenney, it gives her hope that Lessier is still working on her mother's case. She says her mother was a free spirit and a good person, and she wants this case closed so that people can remember Darlene Messer as a person and not just a murder victim. Quote, it's easy to forget all that when there's trauma in the forefront, says Angela. You know, somebody has got to stick up for her. She was larger than life. Me and my uncles miss her. Mm. We think about her all the time. She wasn't just a nobody. So Crime Stoppers of Columbia County is offering a $1,000 reward for information that could lead to an arrest. If you have information, call Crime Stoppers at 386-754-7099. Mm. And that is the story of the disappearance of Deborah Poe and the murders of Donna Callahan and Darlene Messer.
Terrible. I wonder if other areas have that law now about working in pairs.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah.
Because clearly it was a huge problem.
A huge problem.
I should have looked it up. It would be a difficult statistic to find, but how many women were abducted or murdered or disappeared while they were working alone in the middle of the night?
Yes, you're especially in these rural areas. Yeah.
Darlene even had a gun in her purse, but a gun in your purse doesn't matter if they grab you when you're not standing next to your purse.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Just awful.
And that Mark Reby thing, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it when I found Heather's blog post.
Yeah, what the hell?
What the hell? Monster. How many people like that are walking around just living their life? And of course, these women were crack addicted or they're just like an underserved population to begin with. And these fucking guys, it's so awful.
Mm-hmm. It's so awful. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, good job. That was a lot of work.
Thanks.
It's never what you think.
Never what you think. Welcome to our podcast. That took a turn.
Okay.
I have something to share and feel. I watched the Dr. Death television show on Peacock. It was great. Dr. Death is Alec Baldwin, Christian Slater, Pacey, Pacey forever, my boyfriend Pacey. It's really good. But when you're done watching it, and it's definitely worth the watch, they also created a companion documentary called Dr. Death Undoctored.
Oh.
And it's like watching the podcast. So it has the podcast host on it. It's got the two doctors, or the three doctors that went after him.
Ooh.
It's got his ex-girlfriend who, like, he gets pregnant and basically.
Yes.
And it's got his friend Jerry, who he paralyzed.
Yep.
So it's got all of those people. Yes. So you can watch, like, you get to see what they all look like.
Where do I watch that?
On Peacock. They're both on Peacock. Okay, NBC Peacock. But yeah, it is, because it is a little fictionalized. They replace some characters that are white with, like, people of color. They replace some male characters with female characters. But it's still, like, the same. It's very minimal. But then in the documentary, you get to see what everyone looks like, and it's really cool.
Damn, I gotta get in on that.
Who does Alec Baldwin play?
He plays kind of a hybrid of the doctor that testifies on the stand against him, and then, like, another doctor that sounds exactly like him. So I think Alec Baldwin is a combination of the two. And then Christian Slater plays the original doctor that met him first, that had to scrub in and work with him. So he was the one that, like,
He realized something was not right.
But it's so funny because Christian Slater, his portrayal of this man is so over the top, and he's such a huge character. And then the real doctor is also definitely a character, but in a very different way. It's just really cool to see it all, like, come together. And Joshua Jackson is great. He plays, like, this charming sociopath, psychopath. He's really good too. So, yeah.
Cool. I didn't realize it was already out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I binged it, of course.
They've been doing... on the Dr. Death feed. Apparently there's a third season, which I don't think I have yet because I don't have the Wondery app.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been having, like, the cast of Dr. Death on there. One of them is, like, Christian Slater meets or interviews someone.
Oh, cool. He probably interviews his counterpart.
Yeah, probably. Cool. So I can't wait.
Yeah, it's really good.
Of course, that's Wondery. Speaking of Wondery, our very favorite network of all time.
It's definitely our top, I think.
It's our absolute top. I've been listening to Killer Psyche.
What's that?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm telling Allison about a podcast. Oh wow, we have to share Z-Feelsy the same thing. Maybe that'll be next time.
Yeah.
Okay, this is, I'll just read you the tag. When a shocking crime occurs, people ask why. Was it about power, ego, or revenge? On Killer Psyche, retired FBI agent Candace DeLong, fucking queen, one of the first female FBI agents who was a psychiatric nurse before she got recruited to the FBI in the 80s, talks about all these cases that she's been on. She worked on the Unabomber. She met the Unabomber. She was with the Unabomber when they pulled him out of his cabin.
Whoa.
She just sat with him for hours while they were performing the search warrant.
Oh, my God.
She has Eileen Wuornos, the Tylenol murders, the lipstick killer. It's so good. You gotta listen. She is so amazing.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Cool.
It's great.
Okay. I did think of something. Ugh. The controversy is that I don't always care enough about something to share it. But okay. I watched something that I think most people watched at the beginning of quarantine. So I'm like a year behind.
Tiger King?
No.
That bitch Carol Baskin.
No, honey. I watched that one in real time. No, I finally watched Don't Fuck with Cats.
Oh, I could never.
Oh, well, you really couldn't.
No, I could really not, couldn't. Baby.
No. I think you could.
I listened, the last time I ever heard anything about him was when I was still listening to Sword and Scale a million years ago, and he covered it, and I listened to the audio tapes, and I was like, oh, fuck no.
Honey, when I tell you that I kept thinking I knew what was going on, but I did not.
That's what I hear about it.
I was fucking shocked at the end.
You didn't know how it ended?
No.
Oh,
I didn't know anything about it.
Oh,
that's the best way. Don't say anything. That's the best way. That's amazing.
Because sometimes when people are like, you have to watch this, I'm like, okay, I'm going to not see anything about it, hear anything about it until I do.
I heard that story and I just thought it was like a super famous story because it was so fucked up.
You guys. I thought it was going one way, and then it went another.
I know. I want to watch it. I could just never.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe you can just tell me what happens. Like, I have Allison do for every scary movie I watch.
Also, at the time, I was really into learning hula hooping. So I was hula hooping while binge watching it.
Oh my God.
So it was me just mouth hanging open, hula hooping in my living room. Oh my gosh, it was an experience.
Oh my God.
So I recommend buying a hula hoop and then watching it.
Yes, okay, you I have to do it the Carlin way.
I love it.
It was great.
Wow. All right.
Okay. So what are we covering next episode, y'all? It's episode 9, season 4, and I've got a televangelist bomber for you, baby.
Ooh, I'm so excited.
And just get ready for it by watching Righteous Gemstones.
Yes.
You got them.
Okay, and then we have A Lost Loves about Kathy Loving. It is heartbreaking at the beginning, but maybe happy at the end.
And then many people might know this case. In part 2, I have the unexplained death of Beverly McGowan.
I love that case. It's a goodie.
Yep.
And then I'm wrapping it up with a wanted case of Sal Guardado.
Okay, so you can go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you'll get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies. And we seriously have over 80 episodes that you can listen to.
Oh, yeah.
So many.
So many episodes.
Someone recently asked on one of our social medias, like, can you listen to the old episodes that are on, have been posted? And it's like, yes, they are all there for you. You're going to sign up and have a gold mine.
Yeah.
A silver mine.
A silver mine.
I don't want to be full of ourselves.
Probably like granite or quartz. Might be quartz.
There's a couple fucking diamonds in there.
But mostly it's, what do you get in Settlers of Catan? Ore. It might be a lot of ore, you know. Okay. To see photos we referenced in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at ResolveMysteriesPodcast.com, ResolveMysteriesPodcast@gmail.com, or send us something we can hold in our grubbies at P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon 97293. Send us your stories at all those places for listener short stack episodes so we can keep making them. And you could email us or write us a letter about your favorite unsolved mystery story or a cold case or any nostalgia you have surrounding watching the show. We love to read that. Mm-hmm. And last, you hear it all the time, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It helps us out a lot. And if you like us, leave a 5-star rating and even a review if you feel we might read it on the pod. And tell a friend. Carlin is going to read a review that she found that she wanted to share with everyone.
Sure am. Okay. This one is written by NJ Blue Eyes. And it says, love these ladies. This show is fantastic. They do great research and bring their unique perspectives to each segment of UM they cover. I also love their banter and willingness to speak their opinions. We need more strong women like these ladies in the world. So nice.
Agreed.
Thank you, honey.
Thanks, honey.
Just a reminder, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to an organization, and this month's organization is the Epilepsy Foundation. We love ya.
We love you so.
We really do. Happy to be back.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Oh, okay, bye.
Carlin works her little tiny, it's the tiniest booty you ever saw. And no, she it's works not. Her little.
That's not a compliment.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a big, big ass, and she works it off. I'm sorry. It's just funny when people say they work their tiny little booty off of me. Maybe nobody says that. Oh, God. Okay.
Who says that?
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod, where Allison works her. Medium? I don't know the size.
You just
to stop say.
Talking about asses.
Okay. I guess I don't have to say a size. Just her ass off.
Yeah.
You can contact.
It's a reasonable size. Mine's a little more than reasonable.
Mine is. Okay.
Welcome to our podcast.
morning.
Cup of murder.
Ever wonder what terrible thing happened on this day in true crime history? My name is Karina Beemisterfer, writer and host of Morning Cup of Murder, your daily true crime podcast that dives into what murder took place on today's date in history. With over 500 episodes about serial killers, murderers, cults, and cold cases, there is always something new for you to enjoy. Morning Cup of Murder is the perfect addition to your morning routine. So, if you like your coffee hot but your bones chilled, start your day with a Morning Cup of Murder. Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else you listen, and come say hi on social media at Morning Cup of Murder. Oh, and remember, stay safe.